Job chapter 24 is where we find ourselves. So we continue to make our way through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation on these Sunday nights, and within a couple of weeks of finishing up the book of Job. One of the things that a person begins to ask themselves, especially if you've been with us each week as we've been going through the book of Job, is, why does God include this level and this amount of repetition? After, you know, I mean, 37 chapters of it almost. And, you know, the longer we go in it, in the early chapters, as Job's comforters are bantering back and forth with Job, you know, there's some level of note-taking occurring in the margins of our Bibles. And then the longer that it goes on, you know, you just write, see previous chapters, you know, and in terms, it's just like, what in the world? But imagine now, this book, if the exchange between Job's so-called three comforters and Job was only two chapters, only four chapters long, before God then comes on the scene and declares His truth, His perspective, there wouldn't be nearly the appreciation. By the time God breaks through His silence in the book of Job, all of us will shout, hip, hip, hooray! Some level of sanity and perspective is been introduced into this scene. But it's not just Job's comforters, and it's not just Job himself. It's so often as it relates to our lives. He waits until we are sick and tired of hearing what everyone else has to say. And He waits until we are sick of hearing our own voice. And then He breaks through, because it is then that we are willing to listen to what He has to say. Listen, I don't have a terribly high opinion of man apart from God. And the reason I don't is because I don't have a high opinion of myself apart from God. When the Lord came into my life, listen, I had listened to enough blah, blah, blah sessions to last me a lifetime. And I had been an active participant in enough of those sessions to know that I didn't know what I was talking about in them any more than anyone else did. And so it's a thrill to hear God break through in His silence and then bring forth His truth. And so, you know, we continue to lay down that foundation of thankfulness in all of our lives as we begin here now in chapter 24. Job is answering the accusations of Eliphaz against him, Eliphaz accusing Job of being wicked. And that's why he's in the condition that he's in. In other words, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's the same old thing that he's been saying over and over again. And Job, the book of Job. So if you're looking for... Anyway, Job now continues to defend himself here in verse 1. He says, since times are not hidden from the Almighty, why do those who know the Lord not, you know, see not His days? In other words, Job is perplexed as to why those who know Him and those who really do love Him are left in the dark so often as it relates to God's doings. And then Job heads into speaking about the ways of the wicked. He describes the ways of the wicked, and then he describes the victims of the wicked. He said, some remove landmarks, and a landmark was just a stone monument that was put at the border of your property. They didn't really have fences in those days, and so that landmark would be there so that it was a property, you know, border. And so, you know, the wicked would come in the night and move the border on you, and every foot of your property was valuable as it related to, you know, income and crops and all. And so the wicked were, you know, not averse to removing landmarks. They seize flocks violently and then they feed on them. They steal flocks and eat them. They drive away the donkey of the fatherless. The fatherless was typically an oppressed part of society. And so here they take advantage of the weak in society. And, you know, that's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing for the wicked to take advantage of the rich and powerful. I'm absolutely opposed to this class envy that is attempted within our country, and so often even among the political systems. We can't get away from it. It is an election year. But, you know, there's so much of this fighting back and forth and the pitting of one group against another. You know, as if stealing from the rich is okay, but stealing from the poor isn't. Stealing is always wrong. It doesn't matter who we steal from. And hopefully, you know, I use that loosely. Hopefully we aren't stealing from people. But, you know, the most pathetic kind of person is the person who steals from the poor, the powerless, that don't have, you know, the ability to, you know, put the alarm system in their house or live in the gated community or, you know, whatever it might be. And they take their last possession. And that's what he's talking about. These wicked, they'll steal from the most powerless. They take the widow's ox as a pledge. They'll take her one way of making money as a pledge from her. They push the needy off the road. When they get on the road and they want to make their way through, they're so full of their own self-importance that they make the needy get off by the side while they go by, so that the poor of the land are forced to hide. Indeed, like wild donkeys in the desert, they go out to their work, seeking diligently for food. The wilderness yields food for them and for their children. They gather their fodder in the field, and they glean in the vineyard of the wicked. And so he talks about these plundering bands of wicked men that were common in that day. Hey, gangs aren't new. You know, it's the same old, same old. They just didn't have spray paint. And so, you know, they just would kind of head around and, you know, take advantage of other people's property and stuff, and then go in at night and steal from the poor, steal from anyone that, you know, anything that wasn't bolted down, they would steal it. Listen, it's the same old thing. It's the same old thing. The old things are just getting terrible. It's the same old thing. Man has always been the way that he is. He comes right out of the old birth canal, a sinner. And apart from, you know, the fear of the Lord, he involves himself in these kinds of things. And so the poor of the land, he says at the end of verse 4, they're forced to hide. And that's sad when the poor of the land aren't protected. You know, sometimes you'll read in the paper where they've got one of these landlords that owns like a 10 of these roach hotels, you know, in a major city, and they don't clean the walls, they don't fix the heating and all that kind of stuff, and they're just ripping the poor off. You know, they no sooner get their checks and they're just taking advantage of them. And you know, increasingly now the courts are, you know, sentencing these landlords to live in their own units, not only to fix them but to make them live there, you know. And it's a terrible thing to do that to the poor, just a terrible thing to do. And so the wicked, though, they don't care. They only care about themselves. And so involved in that. In verse 7, they spend the night naked without clothing. And that, you know, that doesn't, they're not naked because they do that. They have no covering in the cold. They're wet with the showers of the mountains, and they huddle around the rock for want of shelter. In other words, the wicked are willing to undergo great physical neglect in order to engage in their wicked ways. In other words, you know, the way of the wicked isn't such an easy way. They were in their roving bands. They were subject to the elements, subject to the rain, subject to the cold, subject to all of these things. And yet, as hard as it was, they stay in that lifestyle. They stay in it. And so, you know, so often a person will say, well, you know, they're in that because it's too hard away from it. Hey, it's hard in it. They do what they do because they want to do what they do. That's the way that it is. And so that's why they're the criminals that they are. And so here they are, you know, they're willing to undergo great physical hardship and willing to endure it in order to steal from other people. Some snatch the fatherless from the breast. And so if the father owned or the mother owned money to the owed money to this man, and she was unable to pay, these wicked wouldn't feel anything like just barging in and taking the child that she had right from her breast as a pledge so that she would pay him back, take a pledge from the poor. Verse 10, they cause the poor to go naked and without clothing, and they take away the sheaves from the hungry. They'll take the last article of clothing, the last bit of food from the poor. They press out oil within their walls, and they tread wine presses, yet suffer thirst. In other words, here we have the oppressive employment situation, where the wicked, he's involved in what is outwardly a legitimate business, but he's taking advantage of his employees. And so there they are, they're inside the building, and they're pressing out the oil from the olives. And they're in there making the wine from the grapes that are in there. And yet the whole time they're making the wine for the money making of their owner, they're dying of thirst. They don't even get a drink of water. And one of the things that's fascinating about the day in which we live, we've seen an awful lot happening, haven't we, in the last 10 years as it relates to the corporate world in the United States of America and beyond. We see the downsizing. We see the increases in profits at the expense many times of the worker. And we see people trying to get a grasp on this. I mean, how is it that these profits are greater and greater and greater and greater, and yet none of it is trickling down to the employees, and they aren't being given what is, you know, what is probably due them as it relates to the whole profit structure. And, you know, you can argue about that the owner of the business and all, and the shareholders, they take the risks and all that kind of thing. But there is a place, biblically, we think biblically, there's a place where there's a responsibility to the employee. Not necessarily to make them rich, but to be fair to them. They shouldn't be dying of hunger and thirst while we're making those kinds of profits. There's to be that compassion. Now, the fascinating thing is this. When you look at what the Bible says concerning the end times, it has a little bit to say as it relates to the borders of nations, and it has a little bit to say about the nations themselves. But when you look at what it declares concerning the last days, what is going to be there is, it's going to be, and money is going to be what rules. The businesses, the who's got the money, who's got the resources, that's going to transcend the power of individual nations. And you see it today, where the companies can look and say, if we can't put a plant here and hire employees at this price, then we will find another section of the world in which we can do that. That's the reality that we deal with and the world in which we live today. I am not offering a solution to this, but it's a characteristic of the fact that who has the money, the businesses, the commercial Babylon, that system is going to be bigger than any nation. And it's going to be that system that's going to be used by the Antichrist, you know, as he takes power and all of those different kinds of things. So we're going to continue to see that kind of, again, concentration of power and power that they have that'll even be greater than nations. But sufficient to say for us, that we have to be careful as we look and we're concerned that we have a place in the, you know, business world and that an income is supplied for us and that we're supported in all of this, that we don't forget that God looks at the poor. He looks at the fatherless. He looks at the widow. And there should be a place for them to be able to survive and be able to eat. And so here is this taking advantage of it. And he calls these people wicked. They may be legitimate by the world's definitions and all of that, but God operates by an entirely different set of definitions. They shouldn't be dying of thirst while they're treading out someone else's wine. The dying groan in the city, in other words, it's as bad in the city as out in the countryside, and the souls of the wounded cry out, yet God does not charge them with wrong. And Job says, in other words, God doesn't seem to do anything, you know, about it, these wicked. There are those who rebel against the light. They rebel even against, you know, the light of conscience. They do not know its ways. They don't know the ways of God or conscience, let alone live it, nor abide in its paths. The murderer rises with the light, and he kills the poor and the needy. He looks for, you know, innocent victims, the easy prey, and he works, you know, that way. And in the night, he is like a thief. The eye of the adulterer waits for the sun to go down. You know, sin does like darkness, saying, no eye will see me, and he disguises his face. And in the dark, they break into houses which they marked for themselves in the daytime. So, you know, they have that thing where they spy out a house and see who's going to be there and everything. What's the word for that? They, you know, look in the thing and case it. Okay. Take note of the person that knew that term sitting next to you and that knew right away. Well, they case the houses. Listen, I got to amuse myself somehow. So they case the houses, and then at nighttime they head in and steal from them. They do not know the light. You know, they don't know anything about light. They're awake only in the dark. For the morning is the same to them as the shadow of death. If someone recognizes them, they are in the terrors of the shadow of death. And so for them, the, you know, worst thing that can happen to them is that they would be recognized. They hate the light because they could be identified for their crimes. They should be swift on the face of the waters. And he speaks now of the end that these wicked deserve. They should be swift on the face of the waters. Their portion should be cursed in the earth, so that no one would turn into the way of their vineyards. As drought and heat consume the snow waters, so should the grave those who have sinned. And so he said, you know, their life should be swift. It should come to an end swiftly. And no one should turn into the way of their vineyards. There ought to be a boycott of what they produce, because they're wicked people. And as drought and heat consume the snow waters, and they do it quickly, so should the grave those who have sinned. The womb should not forget him, and then the worm should feed sweetly on him. Again, it's a book of poetry. He doesn't just want to say, you know, and I hope those maggots just eat him to pieces kind of thing. You know, he's got the poet here. And the worm should feed, how shall we say, sweetly on him. And what, you know, you read that, and what is it? It produces a thought in your mind. In my mind, I just see this body disintegrated in the ground, and the worms are eating them away, and sweetly in doing that, you know. So he should be remembered no more, and wickedness should be broken like a tree, or broken like a tree limb. For he preys on the barren who do not bear, and does no good for the widow. And so both the barren and the widow, both of them were an oppressed part of society. They both carried a stigma that they didn't have the favor of God because they were barren or because they were widows. So they had stigma enough without being victimized by the wicked. And then he says, but God draws the mighty away with his power. And he rises up, but no man is sure of life. He gives them security and they rely on it, and yet his eyes are on their ways. In other words, God says he sees their ways, even though he doesn't always deal with them immediately. They are exalted for a little while. And even if a person is exalted for their 70 years, 70 years, it is a little while compared to eternity. And then God says, Then they are gone, they're brought low, they're taken out of the way like all others, they dry out like the heads of grain. And so death is going to stop their deeds, and then comes the righteous judgment. And then Job says, now if it is not so, he says to his comforters, who will prove me a liar and make my speech worth nothing? He challenges his comforters to disprove what he has just said concerning the wicked. Bildad's going to try it. It'll be the last time we hear from Bildad, which will be nice. Bildad the Shuhite answered Job and said, dominion, that is power, and fear, that is influence, belong to the Lord. He makes peace in his high places. In other words, he has cleared heaven of any active rebellion against him. Is there any number to his armies, speaking of his vast angelic armies? Upon whom does his light not rise? How then can men be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? Even if even the moon does not shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, in other words, compared to him, they're dull. How much less man who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm. So again, the poetic side of things, you know. And so he lays out, he's listening to Job talk, and what does he do? He brings up, his little argument that he brings up is that God is awesome, he is almighty, and that man is a worm, that man is unrighteous, that man is a sinner. But the problem is that Job never discounted that. That's not his fight. That's not what he's talking about. And so this guy is going to, you know, rebuke Job here or correct him, but they're not even on the same page. And Job really, you know, he's upset about it. And now he's going to accuse Bildad's little sermon of being superficial, just useless. And Job answered and he said to him, how have you helped him who's without power? Speaking of himself, how have you helped me with what you've just said? How have you saved the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? And how have you declared sound advice to many? To whom have you uttered words? And whose spirit came from you? And so he just brushes aside, you know, Bildad's speech. Says that's absolutely out of place. And he's just kind of saying to Bildad, who are you talking to? What does this have to do with anyone that's here? And what does what you just had to say have to do with me? You know, and just that strong rebuke. You know, how can you think that what you've said is of any help to anyone in my situation? And then Job says, all right, you think you know so much about the power of God, the majesty of God, you want to instruct me concerning these things, all right? Let me tell you what I know about God. The dead tremble. The dead are afraid of God. And those under the waters and those inhabiting them, Sheol is naked before him and destruction has no covering. In other words, the dead aren't beyond God's sight. He stretches out the north over empty space, and he's speaking about the northern constellations. He's saying, listen, God takes and he puts those northern constellations out there and he just hangs them on nothing. That's what he's able to do. You want to talk to me about God and about heaven and all? This is what he's done. And then he says at the end of verse 7, he hangs the earth on nothing. And so that was what Job knew. Now, fascinating, isn't it? Because in Job's day, the prevalent teaching of that time concerning how the earth made its way through space is that it was firmly lodged on the back of an elephant. That was the educational thinking of the day. And Job comes here now, we see that spark of that inspiration of the Spirit where he says, listen, the heaven is hung, or the earth is hung on nothing, just like the earth is. I mean, there's no way anyone knew that in that day is the day of Job. And then he says, God binds up the water in the thick clouds, and yet the clouds aren't broken under it. How can those clouds hold so much water and not tear open? Is it, you know, God's able to do it. And he covers the face of his throne, and he spreads his cloud over it. And he drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. And so he's the one that puts the boundaries on the oceans. He puts the boundaries upon light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble, probably speaking about the high mountains, because they reached up into the heaven, so to speak, and they're astonished at his reproof. In other words, when the storms come in, it even shakes, you know, the greatest of mountains. He stirs up the sea with his power. He's the master of the sea, and by his understanding, he breaks up the storm. By his spirit, he ordained the heavens. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent. And so here we probably have a reference to the fall, and Job would have been familiar with that, especially if his timing was in there at about the time of Genesis chapter 9. The fall of man would have been well known among the population at that time. And he said, as he's speaking all of these things about God, and this is a beautiful poetic verse, he says, "Indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways, and how small a whisper we hear of him." Isn't that beautiful? We see all of this, we examine all of this, we study all of this, and all it is a whisper from him. A whisper of him, a whisper of his existence. All of creation that's around us, all it does is it speaks to us of his existence. Oh my. And that just speaks of his existence, let alone, you know, who he is and the fullness of his ways. I like that in verse 14 he says, "Indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways." And so Job is talking not only about God's creation, but he's talking about God's providence, how God rules the ways of man. This week I was talking with a friend, and he asked me, and he said, "Have you read any, you know, good books lately other than the Bible? We're both pastors." And I said, "Well, you know, I've been working on some, but nothing off the top of my head. I read books and I forget them so fast that I can't even tell." So I just hope something sticks with me as it relates to that. But he asked me that. I said, "You know, what have you been reading? Read anything good?" And he said, "Well, actually, you know, I've been reading, you know, The Rise and the Fall of the Third Reich." He said, "Fascinating." And as it related to Nazi Germany and that whole, you know, Nazi empire. And he began to talk about it, and he said, "You know what's fascinating? One of the things that I see in it, and it just kind of refreshed me, is the providence of God. How he works among men in ways that we don't even recognize." He said, "It's fascinating that the Germans in World War II, when they made their move on Russia and opened up that front against the Russians, having conquered all of the rest of Europe, you know, except for England there, or largely conquered it. When they went against Russia, they, in the midst of that, beginning that assault, it was Yugoslavia that revolted against the Germans. They had been conquered and they revolted. And Hitler was forced to bring his armies back down into Yugoslavia to reconquer that particular country. And it cost him exactly 1 month. And then he re-began his Russian campaign 1 month late, and when they were within a stone's throw of taking Moscow and running completely through the Soviet Union, the Russian winter settled in upon the German army, and they got bogged down in that freezing weather. Their supply lines were cut off. They couldn't move anything in there. And ultimately, they were defeated on that front, and the Russians pushed them back in the spring of that year. The reason that that's fascinating is that if Hitler had been able to, 30 days earlier, take all of Russia, then he wouldn't have had to arm two fronts. There wouldn't have been an eastern and a western front. There would have only been the western front, against the Allies, and he could have massed his troops there, and there would have been no, you know, coming in by sea on that Western front. And so just the insurrection, the second rebellion of one group of conquered people there in Europe causes a 30-day delay, and all of history is changed from what it would otherwise be. And it's that way all through man's history. Napoleon ran into the same thing as it related to Russia. These little things that change all of history as God makes sure that His plan is the plan that unfolds. Chapter 27. Moreover, Job continued his discourse, and he said, "As God lives," and he does, and Job believed it, "who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me, and the breath of God," he recognized that as a gift, "in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit or lies. Far be it from me that I should say that you guys are right." In other words, they kept telling them, confess your sin, confess you're a wicked man, and then, you know, turn from your wickedness and God will give you favor. And he's telling them, I'm not going to confess that, because to confess that would be a lie. This hasn't happened to me because of hypocrisy or secret sin. And he said, "Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast, and I will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live. I am going to die speaking the truth concerning my condition. You guys are never going to convince me to do otherwise." Interesting lesson here as Job is maintaining his integrity, and that is, it's important, and it's neat as it relates to him, is that he refused to be badgered by his counselors. He's outnumbered 3-1. And there's probably a whole gang of spectators gathered around now, because he's going to talk about that in just a moment. And it's the whole world against him. Everyone thinks that Job has got to be wrong here, and yet he will not allow even the greatest number of people who are self-proclaimed experts to badger him into saying or confessing something that he knows is not right. I think that's great. That's hard to do, but he stood there. The second thing that we learn from Job here is the power of a good conscience. If Job didn't have a good conscience, they could badger him all over the map. He'd be really confused in this trial that he was in if he didn't have a good conscience before the Lord. The power of a good conscience, so important. He said in verse 7, as Job now pronounces a curse upon his enemies, he said, "May my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. For what is hypocrite that he may, though he may gain much, if God takes away his life, will God hear his cry? And when trouble comes upon him, will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call upon God?" It appears here as Job is now pronouncing a curse upon his enemies and upon the curse of the wicked upon his enemies, that he's probably talking about his three friends, who he now considers to be his enemies, but probably a broader group. This trial of Job, they estimate that it probably lasts about 6 months. And when this is going on, you know, the whole city's talking about how what happened to Job and his comforters, and there's nothing that some people like better than a good theological word fight. Entire denominations can be built on this. And so as the word gets back into the city that these guys are, you know, talking theologically with Job and they're arguing back and forth, no doubt a rather large crowd is now developing to listen to the arguments, and it seems as if the crowd is in the side of Job's comforters. And, you know, when they would make their comments, yeah, sounds good to me. I think Job's a creep too, and he's probably, you know, the whole thing. And Job's just kind of, you know, sick of the whole thing, and so he pronounces a curse on the whole bunch of them, the curse of the wicked. And then he says, "I will teach you about the hand of God. And now he's going to instruct them concerning the wicked. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? I'm not going to tell you anything you all don't already know. He said, this is the portion of a wicked man with God, and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it's for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those who survive the wicked shall be buried in death, and their widows shall not weep. Though he heaps up silver like dust and piles up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. Now, the fascinating thing about what Job is saying here is he's contradicting everything he said in an earlier argument. In an earlier argument, he said, hey, the wicked prosper. The wicked's children prosper. You can't, you know, say that the wicked always have it bad this side of, you know, glory because they're wicked. Now he's laying out the complete opposite case. And why? He's confused. I mean, he's in this deep, deep trial, and he's just like a pancake. He just flipped from one side to the other. He, you know, one moment he's feeling one thing, and the next moment he's, you know, feeling another and saying something else. And sometimes trials are just like that. And when, you know, when you're dealing with a person that's in the position of a Job, and they do a little bit of that, you know, you just say, well, they're really in some, you know, deep water, and they just got to say some things, and they'll probably say, you know, contradictory things, but, you know, let them say it unless it needs to be corrected for their own well-being. And so, you know, he's saying the exact opposite. Verse 18, he builds his house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman watches or makes. The rich man will lie down, but not be gathered up. He opens his eyes, and he is no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. You know, a flood comes in and takes him away in his bed. The east wind carries him away and he's gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. And so, you know, that was the other side of the argument. Chapter 28, as he continues, surely, he says, there is a mine for silver and a place where gold is refined, and iron is taken from the earth and copper is smelted from ore. And Job is now going to talk about the great efforts that man will go through in order to extract something valuable from the earth in order to gain material wealth. Man puts an end to darkness, and he searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadow of death. He breaks open a shaft away from the people in places forgotten by feet. They hang far away from men, and they swing to and fro. As for the earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it's turned up as by fire. Its stones are the source of sapphires, and it contains gold dust. That path no bird knows, nor has the falcon's eye seen it. The proud lions have not trodden it, nor have the fierce lion passed over it. He puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the roots. He cuts out channels, talking about kind of a strip mining in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams from trickling, and what is hidden he brings forth to light. So speaking about the miner, you know, looking for jewels, looking for gold, and all of that kind of stuff. And he's going to use this as an introduction to wisdom. And the idea is, look at how hard man works to find a little bit of gold. And he's willing to search for it. He realizes that it just doesn't lay on top of the ground. But the fact that, you know, it requires some effort to get down and get it, it doesn't stop him for doing it. And yet, you know, wisdom, you know, he'll search out for these material wealth, but, you know, wisdom he won't search out with the same zeal as he continues the argument there in verse 12. He said, but where can wisdom be found? And wisdom is just knowledge rightly applied. And he's speaking about his comforters here, because his comforters had a lot of knowledge. They knew an awful lot about God. They knew an awful lot about righteous men. They knew an awful lot about wicked men. They just didn't know how to apply the knowledge that they had. And so, tremendous knowledge, but no wisdom, no ability to apply it. We look at, you know, so often as I observe the nation that we're in, and we're no different from the rest of the world. We don't lack gold. We don't lack sapphires. We don't lack the wealth that you can extract from under the ground. We don't lack the initiative to, you know, gain that kind of wealth. What we lack is wisdom. We lack the ability to do right with the knowledge that we have. We don't lack knowledge. We lack the wisdom to properly handle the knowledge that we have. And sometimes it's like that in spiritual circles. You have people who are like these comforters. They have tremendous theological knowledge. They have, you know, all kinds of credentials, all kinds of degrees, all kinds of these kinds of things, and they can't match their socks in the morning. You know, you ever had a guy like that at school? There was one that was in my high school English class. This guy, I'm sure he's building some kind of thing that I can't pronounce. You know, this guy'd come into the math class, and I mean, he, in the whole year, he never buttoned his sweater up in the right holes. He's off the whole year. And every day, he couldn't match his socks. I would watch him. Every day, I would watch his socks. Have you ever seen that Far Side cartoon where it talks about that, shows this scene of the school for the, you know, mentally gifted? And this guy's got all of his books and everything like that, and he's, this door is clearly marked exit, and he's pushing on it with all of his books. He's got knowledge, you know, to build a rocket to reach Saturn, but he cannot get in the building. He can't get in there. Now, there are some people like that, and they are created in the image of God. There are purposes and reasons for them to be on this planet. They are probably creators of everything that makes life a little more comfortable for us. So I'm not minimizing that. But, you know, yet the wisdom has to be practically applied somewhere. I mean, you just can't talk in circles and just think, well, I talked theologically with them for an hour, and that must do them some good. They've listened to me. No, it has to be, the wisdom has to be rightly applied. And so, you know, where can wisdom be found? And Job's, you know, indicating, not in the presence of anyone near me at the moment. And where is the place of understanding? He said, man does not know its value, and we really don't know the value of wisdom. Wisdom is probably the most undervalued thing in the whole world. God's wisdom is. Nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it's not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It can't be purchased for gold. And notice how often he mentions gold and silver and precious stones now. Can't be purchased for gold, nor can silver be weighed for its price. Why can't it be purchased with that? Because it's more valuable than gold. Why, you know, why can't it be purchased for gold? There's not enough gold in the world all put together that could buy one sentence of God's wisdom. That's how precious it is. And yet all of man's effort given to the accumulation or the discovery of gold and his wisdom lies untapped, untouched largely. It's beautiful. Again, the poet in him coming out. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir. in precious onyx and sapphire. Neither gold nor crystal can equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewelry of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or quartz, for the price of wisdom is above rubies. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. In other words, wisdom, God's wisdom, is more valuable than even pure gold. But from where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It's hidden from the eyes of all of the living and concealed from the birds of the air. Destruction and death, they say, we've heard a report about wisdom in our ears. And then here is the source of wisdom, where it comes from. He said, God understands its way and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and he sees under the whole of heavens to establish a weight for the wind and to mete out the waters by measure. Now, this is an interesting thing in verse 25 where he says, to establish a weight for the wind. It wasn't confirmed scientifically that the air and wind had a weight until about 300 years ago. And here is Job speaking about the weight of the wind thousands of years before we discovered it with all of our big brains. And so he says in verse 26, and when God made a law for the rain and a path for the thunderbolt, then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it. Indeed, he searched it out. And to man, God said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that's wisdom. Where's wisdom? Where does wisdom begin? A fear of the Lord. A reverence for who he is, for what he does, for what he says. And the man who fears the Lord is easily recognized. He tells us what he looks like in that next sentence. And to depart from evil is understanding. A man who understands the wisdom of God is one who departs from evil. He repents. He turns from his own way to turn God's way. Listen, once a person understands the wisdom of God, immediately I recognize I don't want to live under my own wisdom. And so a flash, a revelation of God's wisdom is going to cause me to turn from my own wisdom to turn to His wisdom. And remember, repentance is a privilege to be able to turn from our wisdom. Our wisdom is the chapters that we're in the middle of right now. Blah, 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 blah. Chapter 29. Job further continued his discourse. And it's interesting there in verse 1, as it says, Job further continued his discourse. It seems to intimate that Job pauses here and allows his three comforters to jump in if they want to, but they don't have anything left to say. Either Job is confounding them, or they're so disgusted with Job that they feel like this guy won't listen to anything we say. And so Job, you know, continues his discourse, and he said, oh, that I were as in months past. He begins to long for the past. And if you're ever in a trial like that, you know, you just, oh, I remember when, oh, I wish I, and all that kind of stuff. He said, as in the days when God watched over me. And so he's remembering these earlier days of fellowship with the Lord, when his lamp shone upon my head, speaking of God's prospering him and blessing him. And when by his light I walked through darkness, just as I was in the days of my prime. And so, you know, when I loved it, the fellowship that I had with God, when I was secure, even when it was dark, just as I was in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent. Interesting that when his mind goes back to thinking about what he has, the first thing he mentions and he misses is the fellowship with God. When he had a sense of the presence of God, he talks about the communion that he had with God in his tent. And he's saying to his comforters, you accuse me of wickedness going on in my tent. I'll tell you what went on in my tent. communion between God and I, and we communed as friends there. As he says, that friendly counsel. When the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were around me, when my steps were bathed with cream or abundance, and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me, again the abundance from his olive trees. He said, when I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, and so he longs for the past when he had that position of respect in the community, when I had my seat in the open square, when I came to my place there, the young men, they would see me and hide. The aged arose and stood. This is the kind of wisdom that came out of Job's life, the kind of respect that he once had. The princes, you know, those in royalty, they refrained from talking and they put their hand to their mouth lest they would be tempted to talk, you know, when I was speaking. The voice of the nobles was hushed and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. Beautiful picture, isn't it? I mean, you can see yourself in the city gates and all of the talking and all of the hubbub going on, all the wise men, the princes, the rulers, the businessmen, the religious leaders, all talking. And then here comes Job as he turns a corner, and as he turns the corner and everyone sees him, everyone goes silent. Everyone goes quiet so as to not miss a single word that came out of his mouth. Amazing the position that he had, the favor that he had, and how far he had fallen from it in this trial that he was in. He said, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth, and when the ear heard, then it blessed me, when they listened to what I had to say, and when the eye saw, their eyes, then it approved me. And then he declares that he had this position, he had this power, but he didn't use it to, you know, gain wealth for himself. He used his power to help the powerless and to help those who were poor. He said, because I delivered the poor who cried out, and the fatherless, and he who had no helper. The blessing of a perishing man was upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. He'd run into the widows and he'd bless them materially so they'd leave his presence just with their heart singing for joy. I put on righteousness and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban, speaking of the fact that he wasn't walking in willful sin. I was eyes to the blind and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor and I searched out the case that I did not know. When something was being done wrong and it looked like oppression, I wouldn't just ignore it. I'd search it out. And I broke the fangs of the wicked. I confronted wickedness. Not just when it attacked me. Not when it looked like it was going to affect my portfolio. But I stood in the face of wickedness when it attacked people that had nothing to do with me. Why? Because of the way his heart was. It was within him. No matter what wickedness would rise against, he saw it as something that was wrong. And so he broke the fangs of the power of the wicked, and I plucked the victim from his teeth. And so he would rescue the victims from that. And then I said, I will die in my nest. In the day of affluence, he said, oh, it's not going to change. You know, I'm going to die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. All he could see out ahead of him was long days, long life. My root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed in my hand. And so he considers what he thought life was going to be like, you know, after the rest of his life. And then he said, men listened to me and they waited for me to speak. They considered what he had to say worth hearing. They kept silent for my counsel. No interruptions of when Job used to speak, he's saying, nobody interrupted me, let alone argued with me, like you guys have argued with me with false accusations. And after my words, they didn't speak again. It was the end of the issue. God just gave them that kind of favor and that kind of wisdom. and my speech settled on them as dew. Beautiful, again, the poetic side. When I spoke with people, it was like dew settling on them. My speech refreshed them. It gave them strength. You ever been just hot as hot can be? And then you hit something where just a little bit of, you know, water or moisture comes on you, and oh, how good it feels. His words were like that. He said, they waited for me to speak. As for the rain, they counted it precious, and they opened their mouths wide. As for the spring rain, if I mocked at them, they did not believe it, and the light of my countenance they did not cast down. In other words, my favor was valued. I chose the way for them, and I sat as chief, and so I dwelt as a king in the army and as one who comforts mourners. He spoke to us, his comforters here, and he said, listen, let me tell you what my days were like before this came upon me. When I came upon men who were in the condition that I'm in, as you've come upon me, I encouraged them. And that's the witness of my life and the testimony. I never did what you've done to me. And he said to them, if I had ever done to anyone what you've done to me, they wouldn't have believed it. They would have thought I was joking. And so Job here, just in the turmoil of the trial, the difficulty of it, as he continues to bring forth his defense.